Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The true but stranger than fiction story of Paul Weidlinger, characterized as the restless Hungarian, is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious. At age 25, Weidlinger, who hid his Jewish roots in plain view, fled to Bolivia to escape the Holocaust in Europe. 5 years later, he resettled in the United States and became one of the most important and creative structural engineers of the 20th century. The Restless Hungarian is a book and feature-length documentary about to be the 50th movie written and produced by Tom Weidlinger, Paul Weidlinger's son. The story is set against the larger canvas of the Hungarian Jewish diaspora and reflects the experiences of so many immigrants who made a name for themselves in America after World War II. When award-winning filmmaker Tom Weidlinger, a previous guest on Radio Curious, and I visited by phone on January 9, 2016, we began when I asked him to explain how the life experience of his father, Paul Weidlinger, is relevant today.
I guess I'd like to answer that question on two levels. One is a kind of historical level, and the other is a psychological level. On the historical level, it's relevant because the trajectory of my father's life is an expression of some really interesting historical periods in the 20th century. One is the early communist movement in the 1930s in Hungary, the rise of modernism at the same time throughout Europe, and what those modernist ideas meant not only for aesthetics, but also for a philosophy of living, as it were. And then it's historically interesting as a story of the Jewish diaspora. My father was one of a fairly significant group of Hungarians who were all obliged to leave home in the early part of the 20th century and who went and made their mark on the world, all Jews, all hiding their identity, and all very successful, ranging from Robert Capa, the war photographer, Edward Teller, the father of the atom bomb, a couple of other guys, Wegner and Slezard, who worked on the Manhattan Project. So you have all these really interesting minds who left this golden period in Hungary at the early part of the 20th century and made their mark in the world. It's an interesting and representative story of what a lot of people went through. Then there's the whole trajectory of his life through the Cold War. He was not militantly political, that when he was working on missile silos, he was really deeply interested in the mathematics of how to design a structure to withstand a nearby nuclear blast. So there was this fascination with testing the edges of what was possible. In doing this work, he was one of the first people to actually use computers in making engineering calculations to determine what forces structures could withstand. And then later on was one of the first people to use computers in the engineering and design of buildings. His mentors was John von Neumann, who was one of the father of the computer. He was also close friends with a kind of scary person, Hermann Kahn, who was the real-life model for Dr. Strangelove, who was a nuclear warfighting theorist. He had a great friendship and working relationship with Gordon Bunshaft, who was an architect who was probably the architect who was most responsible for what one would call the New York high-rise look, the steel and reinforced concrete high-rise buildings with curtain walls. Paul did a lot of work with Bunshaft, both in New York and around the world. The second level, on which I think this is interesting, is the juxtaposition between the story that one tells about oneself and the story that you glean from other sources about that person, and looking at the discrepancies between those narratives. My father was very much a person who took his destiny into his own hands and is known by most people as someone who was very powerful, completely self-directed and self-made. And in some ways he was self-directed and self-made, but looking deeper into the historical and cultural context, I am beginning to see the cultural and historical forces that acted upon him and made him go one way rather than another way. How his being a Jew changed the course of his life, you know, because he had to flee to Bolivia. How knowledge of the Holocaust may have contributed to his becoming heavily involved in the Cold War. I'm really interested in the juxtaposition of the stories, and certainly in the 40-plus interviews I've now done with people that knew him, as well as historians of the various periods that he was involved in, there's a Rashomon-like effect that he looks different from different points of view and in different contexts. And the work of writing the book and working on the film is to mine those differences, those discrepancies, and see what universal truths might come out of that.
You describe in detail what his world was like of the Austro-Hungarian Empire of more than 150 years ago. And it seemed that, in a way, he was rejecting that world as he grew up. Can you describe that for us?
Well, my father's family was Jewish, although they were not practicing Jews. But they were part of Hungarian society that existed between the aristocracy, the landed gentry, and the large part of the population, which was a peasant class. And Hungarian Jews had benefited greatly in the 19th century from reforms, education, free education, and were the professional class at the turn of the 20th century in Hungary. And so my father was born into upper middle class family. His father, my grandfather, was a very successful builder. And there were these great aspirations for children who would get good education and make something of themselves in the world. He was part of a whole culture of educated, relatively enlightened people that in some ways were the midwives, the sort of helping Hungary come out of serfdom and into the 20th century. He really rebelled against that as a teenager. The critical historical juncture was the end of World War I in Hungary, when Hungary was on the losing side. It lost 70% of its landmass as a result of the Treaty of Versailles. And suddenly, Jews who had been doing rather well became scapegoats. And there was also, at the end of the war, this sort of increasing, glaring discrepancy between the rich and the poor. And a lot of young people in my father's generation saw communism as the solution. At the same time, there was this glaring discrepancy between the rich and the poor. Hungary was called the country of 3 million beggars at the time. And a lot of young people, like my father, were inspired by the ideals of equality that were embedded in Marxist thought. And they became underground communists in a country that was at that time ruled by a proto-fascist dictatorship. So there was this sort of rebellion against the status quo of a lot of young people, particularly Jews, and a lot of the young Jews were attracted to the ideas of communism.
Well, that created the first stage of an interesting paradox in the life of Paul Weidlinger, because in the 1950s and the 1960s, when he was living in the United States, he was a Cold War warrior, building missile silos for the Defense Department in the Defense Nuclear Agency. How would you explain your understanding of this?
Well, I think there's a significant chunk of history that he passed through, you know, between those sort of teenage embracing of communism and who he became in the United States. And that piece of history was the Holocaust. And he was able to escape Europe. He immigrated to Bolivia, really, sort of at the last minute in 1939. But a lot of his family did not. And he carried with him the knowledge of what happened to family members in 1944 and 45. Some of them survived. Some of them went to Auschwitz. But this is something that he never talked about. He never spoke about it to anybody in the family. And I really only found out about it when I began working on this project. And my feeling is that this knowledge of the Holocaust, of how it could completely change the world, and the collective, the sense that it could happen again, anytime, any place, probably influenced his political convictions. He saw himself, along with great scientists working at the RAND Corporation, as helping to protect the world from another Holocaust, from nuclear Armageddon. As we know now, those fears were largely based on bad intelligence about the missile gap. But it was a time, the 1950s, where the whole population lived in fear of a Soviet attack. So he became involved in the idea of designing nuclear silos that could withstand a Soviet first strike. And he did that on and off, along with many other things, for about 20 or 30 years.
Tom Weidlinger is the creator of The Restless Hungarian, a book and a feature-length documentary film about the life of his father, Paul Weidlinger. The Beacon Reader, which funds journalism projects around the world, is currently holding a crowdsource fund for The Restless Hungarian to complete the book and the movie. The Beacon Reader website is beaconreader.com/projects/The Restless Hungarian. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Well, let's step back in the life of Paul Weidlinger for a bit. You mentioned a moment ago that he moved to Bolivia, and we know in the story that he had attempted to get a visa to Uruguay in his desire to flee Europe. And that visa didn't work out. He saw the boat leave the coast of France. And soon thereafter, he was able to get a valid visa to Bolivia. He went with several of his friends. But what is curious to me, Tom Weidlinger, is how does this experience, the experience of your father and three of his friends, all Jews, compare to the other Jews who were fleeing the Nazis, at least leaving Europe when they were able?
These four friends kept a journal as they were crossing the Atlantic, and it's a very humorous journal. It's lots of jokes and comments about the bad quality of the food and getting seasick and so on and so forth. It doesn't read like the journal of people who are refugees. It's four young men on an adventure, you know, going to start a new chapter of their lives in South America. And I think that what was different about these four Hungarians, and there was also another seven who came later, they called themselves the Gang of 13. In a sense, they were all political refugees before they became religious refugees. In other words, they had all been involved in the underground communist movement in Hungary in the 1930s. Some of them had been arrested and pretty much barred from finding work in their professions in Hungary. So they were already used to being exiles in a way. So that was a significant difference. The other difference is that there was Jews who were highly assimilated, who were part of the German-speaking Austro-Hungarian Empire who were fleeing Europe at the time. And there were also Jews who were Polish, from Russia, from Ukraine, Yiddish-speaking Jews who were fleeing at the same time. And these two groups had no fondness for each other. One group was highly assimilated, the other group was fairly religious. And so it's interesting that on the same boat that my father was traveling across the Atlantic on, you had this broad spectrum of European Jewry all fleeing from the Holocaust, from the Nazis, but all from very different backgrounds and actually quite a bit of animosity between the two factions. the Eastern European Jews referred to the German-speaking Jews as Yekis, and the German-speaking Jews referred to the Eastern Jews as Polaks. So there was no love lost between the groups, which I think was kind of interesting. And in the journal that my father and his four friends were keeping, they commented on this and the arguments that developed among their co-religionists.
Added to that, and prior to his departure for Bolivia, he worked for significant and well-known architects in Europe of the time, which led him and gave him a foundation to work in the architecture field in Bolivia and then later in the United States. Tell us about that part of his background.
After he graduated from school, from university in Zurich in 1936, it was still the height of the Depression, and he had no idea where to find a job. He thought that he might be able to find a job in London with someone that he assumed was a relative, who was Alexander Korda, the film producer. But when he got to London, Korda had a couple of flops, and my father was without work, living in a little pension in Bedford Square, and he describes this time as one of quiet desperation, trying to figure out what he was going to do with his life. And one day he was flipping through the pages of the London telephone directory and aimlessly filling in all the O's in people's names with a pencil. And he came across this name which had three O's in it, which is Moholy Nagy. And this name, Moholy Nagy, is a Hungarian name, rang some bells and thought that this guy is famous, has something to do with design. So he resolved to go knock on Moholy Nagy's door and ask him for a job, which he did. Moholy Nagy, it turned out, is one of the leaders, the visionaries of the modernist Bauhaus movement, which started in Germany under Walter Gropius. And the philosophy of the Bauhaus was that art should be accessible to everyone, that things that we use as everyday items, you know, whether they're plates or appliances or chairs, should have aesthetic value and beauty, and that there should be a simplicity. Moholy Nagy gives Paul a job as a draftsman and becomes his mentor. He works for Moholy Nagy for a year in London. And then after Moholy Nagy leaves London to go to the United States to start the new Bauhaus School in Chicago, he gives my father an introduction to Le Corbusier. Now, Le Corbusier is seen by many people as the father of modernist architecture, and some people jokingly refer to him as Pope Corbu. He was quite a character. My father was initially reluctant to go work for Corbusier. He said to Moholy Nagy, "I will go there, and he'll never talk to me. You know, there's many people work for him." And Moholy Nagy says, "No, go, you know, just breathe the air of his atelier and you will learn something from this man." And so my father did. And I think during this period, he was developing his own ideas about art, about beauty, aesthetics, and modernism. And he really embraced the modernist idea, which is not only an idea about aesthetics, but it's also an idea about how people should live in the world. There was this very idealistic, almost militant sense that architecture could actually save the world, that if you built the right kind of buildings that served low-income people, working-class people, where they had access to light, sanitation, good volumes of space, that this would end civil and public strife if you could just build good buildings.
Let me ask you about another significant factor in the life of Paul Weidlinger, particularly after he came to the United States in 1943, and in fact for most of his life. He successfully hid the fact that he was from a Jewish family, yet you're saying he was working in an area of architecture about aesthetics and how people could live a good life in a material way, but he left out a significant part of his life which he didn't share with you for many, many years of your life. So what's going on here?
I don't know that those two things are related. We know that it's very common And I think it's one of the reasons, because it is common, it makes the story interesting, kind of universal. It's very common for people to hide their Jewish identity. I think it's done for different reasons. And in my father's case, I can only speculate as to what his reasons are, but I think that there are probably several. One is that there's this sense that bad things can happen to people that you love, that you care about, and that if they don't know about what happened in the past, that maybe this not knowing is in some way a way of protecting them. So by not telling me of his Jewish background, he probably felt that he was protecting me. I also think that at the time that he came, there was still some anti-Semitism in the United States and the professions, and maybe he imagined, or in fact it could have influenced his career if it had been known that he was a Jew. That's another possibility. I think also there's probably a sense of survivor guilt that he escaped from Europe when many of the other family members hadn't. I suspect that he was reluctant to go back to Hungary and spend much time there after the end of the war.
But he did go back with you at one point.
He did go back with me in 1982 at my request. And I think that he probably needed some nudging from his wife, my stepmother at that time, to do it. And the family history that he presented to me, the world that he presented to me when we were there in Budapest, was quite different from the stories about the family that I discovered on my own after he left. He was a wonderful raconteur, great stories about his hijinks and adventures as a young boy, but no mention of Jewish background or what happened to my grandfather, step-grandmother, aunt during the Holocaust, all of whom survived, but just by the skin of their teeth.
Well, Tom Weidlinger, you have put together the story of your father. You call it The Restless Hungarian. It's two emerging projects. One is the book by that title, and the other is a film of which you have an extraordinary amount of footage. And when it's complete, it'll be the 50th film that you have made. What prompted you to do this project? What was the impetus?
The answer to that question is complex. First of all, as a filmmaker, you know, when I look at a project, there are really three conditions that have to exist to make a project interesting, in my opinion. One is there a story that's worth telling? In this case, I think it's an incredibly dynamic story that spans three continents, encompasses the rise of modernism, the Cold War, some of the greatest architecture of the mid-20th century. So there's really good stuff there in the storyline. The second issue is, do you have good access? Well, as Paul Weidlinger's son, I have great access. I have all his documents and the papers that he left behind. And the third one, of course, is how do you get the funding? And I've been able to do a significant amount of the work on my own savings for the past 2 years, and I'm now actually doing a crowdfunding campaign to pay for the ongoing costs of production and completing the book manuscript.
So looking at the crowdfunding for a moment, how much are you trying to raise?
The target that I need to raise in order to meet the threshold at which funds are released is $50,000. The really cool thing is that the crowdfunding platform, which is a very small one named Beacon Reader, is a platform that supports only writers and journalists, and they have embraced The Restless Hungarian because they are interested in stories about immigrants. As a result of having embraced it, they are matching all donations that are made within a 30-day period starting on January 16th. So that means that I actually only need $25,000 in pledges in order to meet the $50,000 goal.
Is there a website?
It's Beacon, B-E-A-C-O-N, reader.com. And look for The Restless Hungarian. And that will be live on January 16th.
When will that website expire?
On February 16th. So the way these things work is if you reach the goal within 30 days, then you collect the money. If you don't, people's credit cards are not charged.
Well, Tom Weidlinger, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask a couple of questions about you. One of them being, would you tell us about an aha or eureka moment that changed your view of the world or inspired you in your life?
Well, I think working on The Restless Hungarian has really changed the course of my life. There was no single moment that kind of led to it. One was volunteering to work on the reconstruction of a house that my father had built. And through that, becoming interested in him as an architect and as a person in the world, separate from who he was to me as a father. Strangely, by looking at my father as a person in the world, rather than as simply my father, I am learning more about my own self as a person in the world.
And tell us, Tom Weidlinger, what you would like to do with the remainder of your one precious life.
I would like to continue to do creative work that is meaningful to me, and I have been very blessed in being able to do that most of my life. With the current project, that work is getting more personal, and that's a good thing. I want to continue to be nourished and to nourish deep friendships. And the last thing I'll say is I just want to live my life simply and wholly.
And finally, Tom Weidlinger, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Past year, I read a book called Euphoria by Lily King. It's a novel loosely based on some episodes in Margaret Mead's early life. It's about three young anthropologists working in a really isolated region in New Guinea in the 1930s. They're trying to find out what it means to be human in a really deep way. And I just found that really fascinating.
Well, Tom Weidlinger, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you for having me, Barry. It was a real pleasure.
Tom Weidlinger is the creator of The Restless Hungarian, a book and feature-length documentary film about the life of his father, Paul Weidlinger. The Beacon Reader, which funds journalism projects around the world, is currently hosting a crowdsourced fundraiser for The Restless Hungarian to complete the book and the movie. Their website is beaconreader.com/projects/The Restless Hungarian with hyphens between those three words. The book Tom Weidlinger recommends is Euphoria by Lily King. This program was recorded on January 9th, 2016. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new editions published regularly. You may stream, download, subscribe to our podcast service, and share them as you wish. They're all free. We appreciate your thoughts, ideas, and comments about our programs and enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnested and Yuko Kodama are the assistant producers. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.